Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
The Extra Ball.
Hello, welcome to The Extra Ball from The Square Ball. This is Moscow introducing a slightly different episode to the usual Extra Ball format. There's not going to be a quiz. There's not going to be any arguing because the other two ain't here. Who is here with me is Rob Bagchi, who at the moment is a sports writer for The Telegraph, where he's been since 2002. Before that, he wrote for The Guardian, and even before that, he worked at Sports Pages, which, because we're a fanzine at the Square Ball, people may remember Sports Pages as a bookshop in London, and it had a branch in Manchester as well. It's one of the few places, a specialist sports bookshop essentially, but one of the few places you could walk into and buy fanzines off the shelf. He's a lifelong Leeds fan, dating back to what he describes as the arse end of the Reeve era, and he is the author of The Unforgiven in 2002, which is an incredible book about the Reeve era that he wrote with Paul Rodgerson. His new book is called The Biography of Leeds United, The Story of the Whites, just been published by Vision Sport Publishing, and you can get it in all the good bookshops, online, offline, anywhere you can find a book in a pandemic. Should be able to get you a copy of this. And it is an excellent work on the history of Leeds United Football Club from 1919 all the way up to the present day, to 2020. And as many of you will know from listening to this podcast and reading my book, this is a subject that's very close to my heart as well as Rob's. So what better way to spend an hour than the two of us nattering about Rob's career, Rob's life, being Leeds fan, and the history of our football club. Hope you enjoy listening to this. Hello, Rob. Thank you for coming on the Square Ball podcast.
Hello, Moscow. No, it's a real privilege to be here. Thank you.
The author now, as well as previously co-author of The Unforgiven, the best book I've ever read about the Reeve era at Leeds, and probably the best one about Leeds United in general. Now also, The Biography of Leeds United, The Story of the Whites. And we should probably clear up for listeners, because a lot of people listening to this generously and astonishingly, and I'm really grateful, bought 100 Years of Leeds United, which I wrote. And now here we are talking about the biography of Leeds United. And it can be confusing, I guess. People might be wondering, well, I've read one book. Why is there now suddenly some bloke has come along with another one that Moscow's talking about? But a lot of people asked me when mine came out, they wanted to know how long it took. So I think if we both answer the question of when these were written, I think that sort of clears up where we are at. Because I started mine in the Thomas Christiansen / Paul Heckingbottom era, which feels so long ago now, and sort of wrote it through 17-18 with an eye on, we were originally going to publish it at the start of 2019 in the assumption that the centenary year was going to be a full year of celebration. And then it ended up being put back because we realised that October, when the actual centenary was for my book, was going to be the best time for it. And unbeknownst to me, throughout all that time, you were basically working on pretty much the same thing.
Well, yes, I'd, you know, since writing The Unforgiven, or co-writing it, I'd written about Leeds only sporadically, and certainly from 2006 onwards, the commission started to dry up, really. So I would pitch stuff to the editors of The Guardian and The Telegraph, and they'd take the odd piece. But it was only when Gary Monk came, and that season, certainly around September, October, November started to kick off, that there seemed to be some more interest, and they were asking for more and more pieces. And it was around about then that I started having tentative discussions about doing a book. And it was just a case of what kind of book. I didn't actually start writing it, like you, until 2017-18, again with a view to doing a centenary history of the club. But I think I knew that your book was coming out long before you knew mine was, because yours was on Amazon a bit before. And then I saw that Rob Endicott was doing his official book. And though I finished the book right at the end of the 2019 season with a view of it coming out for the centenary, it was really long and hadn't been edited. And even now it's really long. But I think we felt that we had to give you breathing space, because there wasn't, you know, not just you, but everyone, because there just wouldn't be, a market for the same sort of books, even though there is, you know, a difference between the two and the takes are slightly different. But it was a case that we were secretly burrowing away in the same archives at the same time, I think.
Yeah, it's funny. We should have teamed up.
Yeah, that would have been ideal.
And then it would have been even longer. I'm assuming, how many more pages did you write than you were contracted for?
It's half as long again. And you can tell because the font is slightly smaller than I think that they would that they had originally planned it to be. So I think the problem of you know, it's a writerly thing, but filing chapter by chapter is that you think, oh, this is great, but it's like 6,000-8,000 words. And then you don't have an army of editors behind you. So you have to sort of try and cut it down yourself, and then they have a go, and it's still very long. But I think I cut my rate in half by filing 160,000 words for a book that was supposed to be about 90 to 100. Yep.
Exactly the same. I pretty much doubled mine. And I remember I had this, one of my favourite moments of writing it that I always remember is finishing it, because I was well over the deadline and finished it like a kind of a student finishing the final essay. It was 6 in the morning when I did the kind of the full stop at the end of, and I think it must have been Heckingbottom's last season that kind of got that far, and then it was like, right, done.
Yeah.
And emailed it off, and I opened a bottle of champagne and I drank it in 2 hours, watching the sun come up, fell asleep, woke up that afternoon and had an email from the publisher saying, this is great, well done, you need to cut 10,000 words because it's way too long. So, yeah. But the end result now is that we both have these books out, and that means there's now twice as many books for people to read. And as I said before, The Unforgiven is, as far as I'm concerned, peerless. And your work in the Telegraph now and The Guardian before has always been incredible. Whenever I'm trying to tell people about your writing, I always mention that you christened Jose Mourinho as the Warnock of Setúbal, which is just absolutely perfect. So because I'm in the happy position of having lots of people listening to this, bought 100 Years of Leeds United last year, I can't see any reason why. And I'm doing the pitch right at the start of the podcast before we talk about them both, so that people get the idea. If you like reading one book about the history of Leeds United, there is absolutely no reason I can imagine why you would not also enjoy reading The Biography of Leeds United by Rob Bakci, because it's dead good. And and as you mentioned then, it's the same story, but it's told very differently. And we looked in different places and we found different details and different angles and things. And I liken it to, you know, if you're a Leeds United fan, you're not going to say, well, I've seen one game, I'm not going to watch another. You want to watch them every week. So if you want to read another book about Leeds United, this is another one that's out there to get. And people have, I've mentioned this when there was that rush of books around the time of the centenary, there was mine and Rob Endicott and Andrew Dalton had one out, and Heidi Hayes always got new ones on the go. People have lots of relatives who don't know what to buy them for Christmas, don't they? You know, tell one aunt to get one book and tell your other uncle to get another one, and it all works out nicely.
Well, it's really kind of you. And you know, when you relaunched the Square Ball in the guise that you did, and the way that you've been writing about Leeds in the newsletters, and the way all of you have done with this podcast, it's been a huge inspiration to me, because I it's difficult at my age, like I'm 53 now. You know, I got a real sense that the club is a football club from 2009, 9, 10, 11, you know, was really dying. And I think you've kept that flame alive as much as anybody, because I felt we were drifting towards irrelevance, not as a soap opera, but as a club that played football, as this thing of huge meaning for people that had grown up with them and wish them well. And that was one of the reasons that I was able to keep so well informed about it. And the work that you did, particularly on Ken Bates, I just found really energising, influential, and I can't wait to see what's going to come in future years when he's no longer capable of suing us.
Yes, the days when Ken can't answer back are something to really look forward to. I think you must have... So I mentioned you write for The Telegraph now and you were at The Guardian before, but you probably sold the square ball in your days at Sports Pages.
We did, yeah. I worked there from 1991 to 2002, so we had both the square ball and the hanging sheep in the heyday of fanzines, and sold them both in big numbers. I think Leeds have always had a big following in London. What was strange about working in that bookshop, I think like lots of people, I didn't know what I wanted to do when I left university. I did history and knew I wanted to write, but I was so frightened of making the wrong mistake, making a mistake and taking the wrong job and sort of boxing myself in, that a bookshop seemed ideal, even though the pay wasn't brilliant, to say the least, particularly not, you know, having to pay rent in London. But, you know, it really gave me time to almost hoover up the content of the books that were on the shelves, which has been a huge part of informing what I've written since. You know, just taking notebooks of you know, obscure biographies and just getting three or four little lines. And I think, well, one day that might come in useful. But yeah, we did. We sold the square ball and we sold hundreds of fanzines.
And you must have, speaking of influential books going back, Andrew Morant, Leeds United player by player.
Well, in some ways, I don't know Andrew, but he's the forgotten man of all this, really, because both his biography of Reavie and that book, which the player by player, the Guinness, is it Guinness that is on this? Yeah. But it's a work of art. It really is. To be able to write so concisely those short essays about players and just sum up not just how they played but their character, it's a masterpiece. And I'm always surprised that so few people have heard of it.
It was absolutely the book that, I mean, I must have got, it came out when, just after Leeds had won the league, because the title-winning team, 92, is the last players in it. So I would have been 11, 12, and... reading through that, it meant that as a precocious 13-year-old, I could very confidently sort of stitch together. I would be watching John Sheridan playing for Sheffield Wednesday on television occasionally, and I could confidently talk about, oh, well, yes, of course, well, he did this and that for Leeds United, that I know everything about that because I've read this beautifully put together and incredibly written book. But, yeah, it was definitely, that was my guide to so much of the Reavie era and everything that I hadn't seen before. And being able to make those connections between the players who were playing then and sort of seeing Dennis Irwin playing for Man United and looking in this book and saying, he's wearing a Leeds kit here. Why is he now poncing around with the Premier League winners' medal for Manchester United? And sort of learning all that kind of stuff was incredibly formative.
Yeah, I think it was key. I mean, I do remember being that bit older than you, that sort of seeing that team and the back end of, well, the very, very back end of the Reavie era. But it was that book, but also the Glory Years video that came out in about 87, 88, something like that, yeah. That really sort of reconnected the club with its past, really.
Andy P, who writes for the fanzine, once made an interesting point to me about that video, that until it came out, players like Billy Bremner, Norman Hunter, I mean, Bremner would have been the manager at that point, Norman Hunt as a coach, nobody actually really cared about what they'd done as players because they were just old men hanging around doing a bad job of running Leeds United. Alan Clark had got them relegated. I'm sure that there was a lot of the older guard who'd seen them play and still revered them as the brilliant players they were. But to a lot of kids in the mid to late 80s, history was completely irrelevant because you couldn't just go on YouTube and see Eddie Gray dribbling around six players. I mean, how often, probably, I don't know how many times I've seen Eddie Gray's goals against Burnley in my adult life, but it must be hundreds, if not thousands. That might be an exaggeration. I don't care. It's a lot because it's just there now. You can find it anytime. But in 1987, when was the last time that I'd ever been on television? And if you missed it, you didn't see it. So all you knew about Eddie Gray, he was off in probably in Whitley Bay at that point, trying to keep them, get them going. So history for a time in the mid-80s, probably football and Leeds' darkest point, really there to help.
No, it wasn't. I mean, I think you may have been lucky to see them on Football Focus maybe once every 3 or 4 years. And I remember that there used to be classified sections at the back of When Saturday Comes and World Soccer. And you know, you'd send off for videos at 1999. And there'd be compilations that people had sort of taped off the telly, you know, from Calendar or from Look North. And you'd be jarringly, I mean, barely edited together. And, you know, full of tracking and snow. And that would be your only chance until that video came out, really.
And you're... You did see some of Eddie Gray playing as a... You described it to Graham Smith in the Evening Post the other week as the arse end of the Reevey era is kind of when you came to Leeds.
I mean, I'm from Wakefield, so, you know, not too far away. And I'm fortunate enough to have an older brother who's only 15 months older than me. So he was the one who was pushing against the parents, not wanting you to go, you're too young. So I do remember going to a game in that 73-74 season against Man City. But, I mean, really the things I remember most about it are the floodlights and seeing the pitch and the swearing and the smoke, rather than the fact that I know that Lorimer scored and we won with a penalty 1-0. But really, I only know that because I've seen it. It's all about the sensations, really. And then... I mean, we went sporadically for the next couple of years, but from about 76 onwards, I think we had our first junior season ticket, and we went with a friend of my dad's who would take us, and his two lads as well. So we saw, you know, the beginning of the real decline, really.
There was an interesting, well, hopefully interesting point that occurred to me when I was reading that thing with Graham, because you mentioned there that the reason your dad's didn't take you is because your dad's from India and he didn't feel comfortable going to watch football at Elland Road. And I was intrigued by that in a sense of that level of discomfort for your dad. I'm trying to work out, was it some kind of act of rebellion that you were like, well, you know, maybe my dad can't go there, but I can. But that's quite an interesting break to make. I can imagine I wouldn't want to take my dad to a gig if it was a band that I liked, but I would know at least I could take him and it wouldn't be a problem. Whereas football matches in the 70s, 80s seems like a different deal.
Yeah, I mean, the strange thing is that we subsequently learned that he had actually been in the 60s a couple of times, and he came over from India in the mid-50s to do a postgraduate medical thing, and he went to Edinburgh. And from Edinburgh, he then went to Middlesbrough. So he'd been to Ayresome Park and he'd been to Elland Road when he started working at Huddersfield Hospital Infirmary. So he'd been to Elland Road a couple of times. But I think by that point, I mean, I don't know whether it was a fear of racism or what would happen or whether it was a rebellion. I mean, he was very okay with us going. I think part of it was that he was more of a cricket man. Sorry, I think that's an alert from on my iPad. I'm sorry about that.
That's all right.
And it wasn't necessarily a fear of the racism, though. I wouldn't have wanted him to go in you know, the late 70s, early 80s, a bit later than when we started going, because then it turned truly toxic. I'm not sure if it was a rebellion against that, because he was quite up for us going, and it, after all, it was his money that paid for the ticket.
Leeds is always an odd club, and it set me thinking about the character of the club historically and how it is now, because although it did have that terrible strain of racism and fascism throughout the 80s in particular, which was as bad as it was anywhere from what I've read, obviously not being there at the time and not being on the brunt of it at any point, but Leeds has also been quite a homely place for outcasts in many ways. It's always embraced the weird. It's always been comfortable with Albert Johansson, and before him, Jerry Francis. And there's John Armand's name came up in the years before. I think he was pre-World War II as well, wasn't
he? Yes.
So there's this very rich history of being very welcoming. And to the modern day with Robbie Rogers, I think it's always significant that the only openly gay professional footballer was given a round of applause and a lap of honour around the pitch after he'd come out and come back to Leeds. So always trying to reconcile these two sides of Leeds and how badly wrong it went in the 1980s when either side of that, it's been a club with a kind of a weird is probably the wrong word, but I think about it's because I've been writing today about Marcelo Bielsa and Major Buckley and all the strange sort of quirks that link those people in Leeds being a place where it's kind of like if you are different in some way, it will just say, well, that's just you just be you and we'll be fine with it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that, that we have been a welcoming place for players of colour once they're actually in. It was, I mean, the racism, the overt racism was always to the opposition, largely. I mean, they say that Terry Connor used to get stick off his own fans. I can't say I ever witnessed it, but I wouldn't be surprised because the level of racial tension and hatred that was pouring out at that point, you know, was on that scale. And, you know, the sight of so many people selling magazines and what have you outside the ground was always more dispiriting. But it never really put me off. I went to school with Anand Menon, who was invited on to do that Great Lives programme, and he chose Billy Bremner. Anand, both Anand's parents are from India. And he said that, you know, he remembers going to Elland Road for a Forest game where every single player, he said, you know, that everyone in the West Stand got up, including the people who'd taken him because he'd gone to someone's birthday party and started abusing Viv Anderson, even though he was stood next to him. And the guy on the programme, I was there as, I mean, he got me the gig only because I know him, really, but I was there as the so-called expert on Bremner. And one of the things that the presenter said, you know, was, why didn't you just walk away? You know, why didn't you just, you know, if people of colour. And I don't think it ever crossed my mind to do so. You know, it's the same reason that people who disagree with Blair don't leave the Labour Party, or people who, you know, disagree with Corbyn haven't left the Labour Party or didn't. And it's, I think it's you stay and fight for what you, I mean, I wish I'd done more with the Leeds, you know, we sold the Leeds United Fans Against Racism and Fascism fanzine in the shop, and we made sure that, you know, they got paid and everything. But I wish I'd done more in that rather than just, you know, sort of experiencing it and feeling a bit intimidated by it, you know, in 81, 82, 83, around then.
Those ties that sort of bind people to Leeds United are interesting. That strength of feeling that it can generate that overrules almost common sense in a lot of ways is an interesting factor of the story of the whole club, because it's something that really comes out strongly in your book, is how indifferent a lot of the city of Leeds has always been to the fact that there's been the world's greatest football team at one point playing down at Elland Road, and Don Reaver used to despair that he couldn't fill what was not even a particularly huge stadium at that time. Whereas it's sort of a chicken and egg question that I kept coming back to as to whether the late arrival of soccer as well, and kind of the way that rugby league dominated everything, means that the people who actually got into Leeds United as an association football club, who started it, kept it going, restarted it after Leeds City have been, followed it throughout Europe, and then in the last 15 years followed it to Exeter and Yeovil and everywhere else, absolutely 100% committed to it. And yet it's a club in a city where the vast majority of the population wouldn't care if it closed down tomorrow.
Yeah, I think I said this to you earlier that you know, I don't think we've ever been more popular than we are now. And certainly, you know, the O'Leary team selling out the ground did it far more often than the Reavy team did. There's a bit right at the beginning of Bremner's autobiography you're getting out for being second, where he talks about it's going to take a generation of success for people to truly embrace this team. And it's almost like it's right at the beginning of the book. He talks about, you know, people saying that the half-back line of Bremner, Charlton and Hunter, it isn't a patch on what came before, you know, that we can't ever hope to compare with Willis Edwards, Ernie Hart and Wilf Copping. But what's really weird about that is that nobody wanted to watch them play either. I mean, they did, but nothing like the capacity that you would have expected to go and watch them play. You know, they'd built all these big stands in the 20s and 30s. They discovered the players. That's an all-England half-back line, isn't it? Edwards, Hart, Copping, you know, played at different times. And the crowds, even given the economic situation of the country, keep falling year on year.
There's an interesting way, a bit of a track as well. And we were both tracking the crowds, I think, through the books. And when it goes up, when Leeds are about to get relegated, as if people in Leeds, and there was one report that said that Leeds were the absolute talk of the city because they were going to get relegated from Division One in the 1920s. But people still didn't go and watch them play. But then when they did get really bad, they would go because they wanted to see how bad this was. It was almost like an invitation to an execution or something. That was there's something really macabre going on down at Elland Road. We'll go and have a look at that.
Yeah, there was always a solution, wasn't there, put forward, like, you know, that, well, we'll build Lowfields Road. We'll get a tram to come round here. We'll get better trams to take them back to Swinegate quicker. We'll, you know, it's never happened, but we'll build a railway station, you know, down at the bottom of Elland Road. All these things were seen. It was seen as somehow that its location maybe was one of the reasons that it couldn't attract people. But I think you're right. I think towards the end of those seasons, people came at crunch moments. Maybe just to watch the drama, maybe to watch the spectacle of how bad it is. And you know, it's always been a notorious crowd for booing its own players, hasn't it? So it's
that's one of my favourite discoveries is the report in the, I think it's the start of the 1930s, and I think it's the Yorkshire Post from memory, but they do a comparison, and it's something I keep coming back to with the same question about the particular character of Leeds United within the civic city of Leeds, where he makes the point that the crowd at Hunslet Parkside watching rugby league, they cheer them from the first minute to the last. They love all their players. They support them from the first whistle to the final whistle. But half a mile away at Elland Road, if the players aren't, you know, a goal up within 5 minutes, they're on the backs, they start booing. And it's a real consistent theme of people at the club appealing to the supporters, saying, "Look, will you please get off the players' backs?"
Yeah.
And that article really laid it out that it's not Leeds people, you know, it's not a problem with people from the city of Leeds. It seems to be particularly just that little bit of Leeds centred on Elland Road. The people who want to go there have this weird thing that's different from the rest of the city.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, there's four of us would have season tickets next to each other for years, and it would be just a constant, you know, it'd be constantly moaning between us. It would be F word after F word. It would be just like a go up and down the line constantly. And that's how we've always approached watching Leeds, that, you know, maybe the standards that you aspire to are always, or always were, sort of tantalisingly out of reach. So you're always sort of venting this disappointment. But I wonder if rugby league, because it's such a conspicuous endeavour, isn't it, to play rugby league? There's a lot of smashing. You can tell when people are really trying. And with football, I mean, obviously you can tell when they're trying, but it's easy to pretend that they're not trying. And you know, all those cries of the 50s of get some blood on your boots or get into them and all that. It seems as though they want a really, what's the word, like a really visceral experience out of football. They want a bit of blood and thunder. This is something that maybe has affected the character of the club, as well as its relationship with the city.
And on the location as well, I've just found a page in your book where this has got to be, it's the 30s, I think, somebody writing to the Yorkshire Evening Post under the name of Lover of Sport and Fresh Air, saying that after a week's work, it requires a strong will and enthusiasm to go down Holbeck Way when there's hardly a green leaf or a blade of grass to be seen. Even as you stand in the ground, you seem to be weighted down by the heavy atmosphere. And when it's wet, dull or nasty, it's quite enough to make anyone stop at home. What a pity the ground could not be moved to Roundhay, Headingley or Chapeltown, or it would be a pleasant ride or walk, even if your team does disappoint.
It is. I was thrilled to discover that, because there's something in the 50s as well where someone, actually, I think it's during when Charles was re-signed, complaining about the ground being in the wrong part of Leeds. And you think, you know, I'm not a Leeds native, you know, from 10 miles south. And it never really dawned on me how territorial or you know, just that concept of want a nice day out, you know, rather than it's not the football so much, it's the whole day's experience. I wonder if it had been in the north of the city, would it have made much of a difference? But I don't know. I mean, there's this huge thing at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century where football, in certainly in the West Riding, is just seen as entirely a Sheffield thing, isn't it? That all the other clubs that came through, it was always like Sheffield was the centre of Yorkshire football. And because there was massive enthusiasm for it in Sheffield, but this was Northern Union territory.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I have a theory that I didn't put it strongly in the book because it sort of occurred to me afterwards when I was looking at it again and trying to answer this question of what is the problem with Leeds United fans and just soccer. I still like the word soccer in Leeds in general. I sort of have this idea that because rugby in general was tied to church, and so that would be Saturday and Sunday taken care of. And then in summer, the rugby club switched to cricket. So there wasn't a break. And you only had half a day off from work. It was only Saturday afternoons that people got off. So you only had one choice. And it was very drilled that society in Leeds for workers was rugby, church, and that's your leisure time all taken care of. So then the people who ended up being interested in soccer and starting soccer clubs and getting into that, my idea is, are they the people who didn't go to church, who didn't have this kind of this strong moral Christian fibre, basically the criminal element, the people who were just ne'er-do-wells, didn't bother going to church on Sundays, had leisure time, but had never been sucked into the idea of, it was muscular Christianity was what linked sport and church at the time. Whereas the earlier beginnings of association football in other places, where it was kind of a stronger rival to rugby at the outset, or in other parts of the country, there was no rugby for it to have to overcome. They never had that problem, and it just meant that, Leeds City, I suppose, the way that it ended up going down under all sorts of financial shenanigans, and then Leeds United having these terraces full of people who would just stand there and yell mean things at all the old players, just suggest that it's all the not nice people who got into football in Leeds.
Well, I think there's something in that. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a line in your book and in mine, I think, where where they say in the 20s or the 30s, when they're doing yet another fundraising initiative, you know, we've had great support from the licensing trade. And I wonder if that's got, you know, maybe temperance people, maybe, you know, the church was a rugby thing. I don't know, but I think it's a really interesting thesis.
A lot of this, we've immediately gone into the pre-Reeve era, which is significant, I think. I know you wrote The Unforgiven, which is about the Reeve era, and you've mentioned to me before that in the years before Don Reeve came, and I don't think you're alone in thinking this, nobody really has ever bothered about Leeds United pre-Reeve. There was John Charles, and we know that Major Frank Buckley was famous at Wolves, but other than that, it felt, I had the idea, certainly before setting out and writing it, that doing the part of the book before Reeve came would be difficult because there would be essentially nothing to talk about, because the fire in the West Stand in 1956 being a really significant part of it, meaning that all the records just aren't there. It's all destroyed. So how do you find anything? And then secondly, well, Leeds were just rubbish then anyway. So I approached that period thinking it's going to be difficult to find anything to say, but also I'll probably get through it in a couple of chapters because there won't be anything to say. How wrong I ended up being. And
me and you both.
What page does Reeve turn up in yours? Let's have is somewhere around, just at random, right, John Charles is being sold on page 127. So a little bit after that, so about page 150, which is not far off halfway, which is not what most books about Leeds United's history have been like.
No, and I think, I mean, one of the things that I wanted to do was, I co-wrote that book with my friend Paul Rogerson, but we focused very narrowly on that period, presuming that nobody would be at all interested in anything that had gone before, as you say, because nothing appeared to have happened. And I mean, it was a different process back then, but I mean, I essentially wrote the first half of, you know, the early part of the book, and he wrote the last bit, and then we sort of rewrote and melded it together. So it was my line saying at the beginning, saying, you know, it was one long phony war. Leeds United might as well not have existed before 1961. And, you know, what a cruel, flippant, dismissive thing to say. But at the time I wrote it, I genuinely thought, apart from John Charles, who's, you know, we did mention, I thought it was pretty much accurate, or an accurate, in truly empirical terms, is that the right word? You know, it, in terms of success and in terms of impact, it had been a complete and utter waste of time. But going back and deciding to start in 1919 with this one, like you, I thought no one's really going to be interested. But the problem was, the more you dug, the more fascinating it seemed. And the themes that are there in 1919 are still here today. As we talked about this, in a sense, the club has an unrequited love affair with the city, not the other way around. You know, the club is always asking for people, or was until very recently, you know, he's always just saying, you know, come on, please support us, please love us. And the city is the one that turns its back. But now that's, you know, that's changed in more recent years. But those themes from, you know, the struggle to establish the club, and then, you know, the whole Huddersfield business and the fantastic stuff about Hilton Crowther, the having to hire someone to, well, you know, we don't know exactly what happened, but, you know, get a correspondent in so that he can get divorced, and then he marries somebody else, and needing the money to pay for his divorce. You know, it's all just really fascinating.
And it's quite significant as well. I mean, Hilton and Mona Vivian is the woman he ended up marrying, the stage star he ended up marrying, and the way that meant that the club had to repay its debt. For people who've not read either of these books, Hilton Crowther had been, he basically, after failing to move Huddersfield to take Leeds City's place at Elland Road, bankrolled Leeds United until they were promoted. And then, coinciding with his divorce, said, right, I need as much of that money back as you can spare. And then announcing that he needed it now, otherwise the club was going under. And that ended up, I think one of the reasons Leeds was essentially nothing before 1961 was having to pay that debt. They were under, it was a £35,000 bond that they were paying. They had to pay the interest on that every year. to the bondholders before they could even think about signing a footballer or improving the stands. For 25 years, it took them until the 1950s. So there's a huge explanation there that was a really exciting thing to discover. That's why we were rubbish.
Yeah.
And what a story.
It was. I mean, but it's the thing that the bond was a remarkable investment opportunity for so many people. And they did it. They did drum up just about enough to pay off Crowther. But, you know, the price that they paid for that over the next 20 years was just, you know, it cut the club off at its knees. You know, it's why they sold Copping. It's why they sold Sproston. It's why, you know, we were a selling club, you know, because they needed every year to get this money to pay off the bondholders, to give them their interest. Because interest rates had crashed, hadn't they, during the Great Depression? I think bank rate was down at 2%, and they were still paying out 7.5% return on these bonds, because that's what they'd agreed to when they'd borrowed the money.
There's two ways of looking at the kind of the city's rush to save the football club in 1925. It's the Lenders a Fiver campaign, which is one of the few bits of sort of surviving I call it prehistory before Revie, because there's the Pathé News footage that you can see on YouTube and places. But the one way of thinking about it is that, oh, there was this sudden groundswell of support within Leeds that said, well, if the football club might be about to go under, so we better get down there and save it. And these stories of people going down there with bags of pennies that they've been saving for years and saying, yeah, I'll buy a bond. But then the other part of it is exactly as you said, they were offering 7.5% interest. So it's no wonder everybody in Leeds was like, right, bloody hell, I'm getting down there because I'm going to make a killing on this and sod the football club.
Yeah, and the times that they had to go back to the bondholders and say, can you take a holiday? Can we cut the interest rate? They did take it eventually, particularly, you know, in the run-up to the war and then during the war. But there was very little, you know. They also put, you know, the possibility of debt forgiveness. You know, they'd had a significant return on their fivers that they'd put in. You know, can you write it off? And nobody, or nearly nobody, said yes. It was like, well, hang on a minute, I want my money, which is, you know, fair enough. In one way, it just saddled the club with, well, it was like a millstone, wasn't it, throughout the 20s and 30s, that they could never escape from it.
I still think I attribute it to why we had to end up selling John Charles, because the money that could have been spent on a new main stand was all going on paying this stuff as well. And so suddenly 1956 comes along, we're in Division 1, we've got the world's best player who we've been hiding in Division 2 for 5 years. But because nobody spent any money on that main stand since about 1905, when it was first built and they put a roof on it for Leeds City, one night, electrical fault, boom, all gone, John Charles sold. And we'd started so well that season as well, our first season back in the First Division, you'd think, you know, we were ready to establish ourselves. But because nobody had spent a penny on the stadium for 25 years, that came back to bite us at just absolutely the worst moment. So I blame that deal for absolutely everything.
Yeah, well, I think you're right that it does have that really long tail that leads up to well through the 50s and beyond, you know, until, you know, we get to Revie, and success is the one thing that finally turns a club's financial situation around. Only temporarily, we find, but it did.
There's a message there for what Ken Bates used to tell us and what we always used to say. A good football team, it can do a lot for a football club. But you mentioned, or in amongst the kind of the off-field stuff, some of the names we've mentioned: Ernie Hart, Willis Edwards, Wilf Copping, Bert Sproston. The players that we had in those years, particularly sort of the pre-World War II, Ernie Hart racked up 472 appearances, Willis Edwards 444, and he ended up managing the club and was still there when Revie turned up. He was on the coaching staff when Revie became manager. We actually had some very, very good players, if not good teams. There were a couple. Dick Ray managed to get us up to fifth in the First Division, was the best pre-Revie finish. But there's some names back then that are not to be sniffed at.
They are. And you know, you look at that top 10 of Leeds appearances, and it's nine Revie boys and Gary Kelly. So, you know, you're blind to the fact that these lads from the 20s and 30s were one club men largely who you know, served for 12, 13, 14 years, picking up their England caps. And yet, you know, it's my own ignorance. I admit it, but I'd never really heard. I'd heard their names, but I didn't really know anything about them until we went back in it and saw how influential they were as players and how well regarded they were throughout football. Because it wasn't easy to get picked for England in the 20s and 30s. You know, you had a lot. It was a selection committee, and there's a lot of competing interests and different clubs. And Leeds never had anyone close to the selection committee to bang the drum for their own players. So they must have been really good. And certainly one of the things that we spoke about is the material you've got to do your research with. Football is very secondary to a lot of the reports in the 20s and 30s. They do the results, but they don't actually tell you a great deal about what they were like. So it's only when Copping goes to Arsenal and he's like in the national press and there's proper, you know, match reports that we would recognise as match reports, that you start to see what kind of player he must have been when playing for Leeds. A fearsome one, by all accounts. But as you said, you know, when we spoke before this, you know, at any other club, you know, Willis Edwards would have a statue. There'd be plaques about Ernie Hart. There would be, where is this museum that we've been promised for so long? You know, these people would be in it, and they would deserve to be in it. So I'm very remorseful for writing them off.
Well, we gave lots of credit to Andrew Morant before, so maybe we'll give him some criticism now, because his player-by-player book does just have, I think there's two pages at the start where it just kind of has statistics about the pre-Reevy players, and then it starts with the team just before kind of when Reevy turned up. So he's probably given greater space in that book to some absolute, I mean, it sounds unfair, but dross that was keeping us down in the bottom of Division 2 when Reevy took over as manager, whereas these excellent players like Wilf Copping and Ernie Hart and Bert Sproston don't merit a mention. There's McDonald and his mate.
Jared, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Their book from the mid-80s that had more details on those, but as well, I mean, criticising with one hand, but I think we've both discovered that the ease of digitised newspaper archives just completely changes the game.
It does.
When it comes to this.
Certainly, I started doing The Unforgiven in 1999, and it was a case of you had to physically go to Leeds Library or the Colindale Newspaper Library, and if you had money, you could afford photocopies, but they were like 50p a shot, so you would just be taking notes off microfiche, and you'd just be scrolling through newspapers looking for just mentions and references. So that British Newspaper Archive online, even though it only goes up to 1945 in any huge depth, is a godsend.
Yeah, but it does still stand, though, I think, that if you look at a club like Everton, where, you know, Dixie Dean is revered, and I think every young Everton fan knows who he is, whereas our sort of equivalent of him, Tom Jennings, there is definitely a pre-Reevy just kind of black hole at Leeds, where the same assumption that we started with, well, they all got burnt down in 1956. Yeah. John Charles was brilliant. We don't need to worry about anything else too much.
And yet, you know, as we've discovered, both pre and immediately post-war, it's the character that has shaped the club is there to be seen in those struggles. And yet, you know, even in 1947, when they've been relegated, they can still attract a manager of Frank Buckley's calibre. It's always been seen as ripe for potential, you know, as a project for somebody that they could get hold of this club, that they could make a real success of it. And some of them are quickly disabused, and, you know, and within a few months are moaning about the fact that the crowds haven't come up or the difficulty of finances and getting players. But everybody sort of arrives with the view that certainly then, you know, they're going to be the man. They're the one that's going to actually make this into an institution.
Are you thinking of one Horatio Carter?
I am, yeah. And what a wonderful player he was by every account. And yet as a manager, he comes across as a bit of a shit, really, doesn't he? His attitude towards the players was so condescending and patronising that there's a famous story, I think, that John Charles told that when he went into a pay rise, that he just hooked his finger behind his shoulder and just went, you know, you'll not be getting a pay rise until you're as good as him. And he pointed to a portrait of himself behind his desk, which was, you know, it seems to summon him, you know, the spirit of Rach up all over as a manager.
He's a funny one, because, and I think he's integral. So in the timeline, Major Frank Buckley came after World War II, when we'd bombed straight out of Division One as a World War II reference. Yeah. I probably could have put that better, but I'll stand by it. Yeah. Willis Edwards took over for a season, and it all went drastically wrong, and Billy Hampson had come back after the war, and it was just a mess. Frank Buckley came in, and he didn't get Leeds promoted, but he did a bit of a George Graham job in a way of building, not the, I suppose Graham didn't pay the attention to the infrastructure, so it's a bad comparison. Buckley himself, will keep him singular, built something like a modern football club at Elland Road, with a scouting network, with youth systems, something that Reevey became famous 4 years later, and obviously Howard Wilkinson as well in the 90s. But Dick Ray, back in the late 20s and 30s, had been absolutely devoted to the idea of developing youth players. So there's kind of another sort of Leeds United strand going all the way through. And although Buckley couldn't get us promoted and ended up quitting because he thought that Walsall, who were bottom of the entire football league, yeah, had more ambition. But then Rach Carter came in, took over, got us promoted, but probably also simultaneously set the club back, if not 10 years, five. I'm trying to think what would be the gap between him and Reevey. Probably 10 years from Rach Carter finally being absolutely astounded that a man of his stature would not have his contract renewed by the club that he had been slagging off in the press all season.
Yeah.
To when Don Reevey finally got them back into the first division.
Yeah, I mean, that neglect of the youth system and his complete, that line of his about, you know, you can either play or you can't play. There's this Jack Charlton there, you know, in his autobiographies, you know, just saying how much he was yearning for some direction, for someone to tell him what to do, and then all they'd ever do was play five-a-sides and you know, sprint one length of the pitch, jog the other up the goal line, and then you know, jog round. So they do walking, sprinting, jogging, sprinting, you know, and that was their training. You just felt that this club that Major Buckley had sorted out Fullerton Park, I think, and made sure that the training ground was sorted. And then Rach comes in, focuses entirely on the first team, still picks himself in these floodlit friendlies that help turn the club's finances around a bit, always there hogging the limelight. And then he did lose his best player in Charles, obviously, and it would have been very difficult for Leeds to, you know, find somebody even approaching the weight of goals that he brought to the team, never mind the leadership and everything else. But then, yeah, it's to be surprised that he got canned when he'd done nothing but really make enemies among the squad and with the directors and everybody else.
It's funny with John Charles, because he won't say anything bad about anybody, and I think that's his character all the way through. And yet, I think he detected Rach Carter. It must have been entirely one way, basically. Rach Carter, who had finally retired from football pretty much the day before he became manager of Leeds. He was swanning around the League of Ireland on huge wages, just winning every trophy and being feted by everyone. Suddenly he's at Elland Road, and this, apparently, John Charles is supposed to be better than him. I don't think he was ever having it, and I think Charles recognised that, and he's the one person who kind of not having.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. Charles has not got a bad word to say about anyone, you know. Having lost all his money, you'd think his book would be full of you know, bad-mouthing the people who ripped him off. But the only actual person that he has any animosity towards is, and even then it's done in that typically polite way, but it's there, it's Rach Carter.
One of the things that becomes apparent when you mentioned Jack Charlton there, where we're talking about John Charles and when we're talking about Major Frank Buckley, and sort of tying the 101 years now of Leeds United together, is a name like Major Frank Buckley has always felt like it's completely ancient history. And the stories with him that lots of people know, most of them from Wolves, about him injecting the players with monkey gland serum and all this stuff, it feels like it happened in a completely different time. This year, it's only a couple of months ago that we lost Jack Charlton, but he still feels like a part of the, because he's so associated with the Reevey era and then with managing Ireland and with being present on the television and being very present in people's minds, you wouldn't necessarily think he went back that far. But that's where the link starts to come. Jack Charlton made his debut for Major Frank Buckley, and it was his final act before departing. And he'd had him there as a schoolboy for a year or so. And when further back from that, Rach Carter Leeds had tried to sign him before. He managed Don Revie at Hull and had worked with Major Frank Buckley. So when you start thinking about those years before Revie, the longevity of some of the people that we actually knew, Don Revie's story himself going all the way back to being managed by Rach Carter before inheriting his job, it starts to sort of, I felt like uncovering all this stuff about the pre-Revie era really tied a lot of the loose ends of what we knew about Leeds United together in an era when I never thought the answers would lie.
I mean, that's right. The fact that you look at Jack Charlton in the right at the beginning of the 50s there, making his debut for Frank Buckley, and then, you know, still going off on his national service, coming back. But you think that at the end of his career, he's playing against Kevin Keegan, and at the beginning of his career, he's playing alongside Albert Nightingale. And you think, you know, what this is the huge span of what Jack did. And because Jack is more relatable to us from 1973, we can see a clear path back to 1973. Or people of our generation, or my generation, sorry, I'm not lumping you in with us geriatrics.
Well, even the modern era, he managed Gary Kelly for Ireland.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, so, but it does. It's like certainly for the last 60 years, 70 years, isn't it? That you can see a link, and that link begins with Charlton knitting it all together. And, you know, I always found it quite moving that even in 1996, that Revie's been dead for 7 years, that Charlton dedicates his autobiography to him, you know, to Don Revie, you know, the man that made everything possible. And he did, but Jack also played a huge part in that.
And then at the other end of history, if you want to put it that grandly, Marcelo Bielsa, where do you think he fits in to a 100-year picture of Leeds United Football Club?
Well, I think that he's everything that we've ever wanted, and that sounds trite in a way, but he's... The ability that he has had to unite the club and the city from where we were, the ability that he's had to build a coherent structure and have a way of playing that, you know, we find so enthralling. We've finally got someone, I'm not saying that Revie or Wilkinson don't have great stature, but we finally attracted someone who we think is up to it, who's worthy of the task that our own perception of what we are as a football club. We've got Marcelo Bielsa because we deserve to have Marcelo Bielsa. And, you know, you can get very roomy-eyed about how wonderful it's been. And yet, you know, I hear all the time on social media and other places that people think, you know, well, he should park the bus or he should do a... I do think it's a fundamental misreading of who he is, you know. You get Marcelo Bielsa, you get Marcelo Bielsa. That's it. There's no point getting him and trying to neuter him. So I've the last 2 years have been among the most enjoyable I've ever had. And I think I would put him second only to Revie. And that sounds ridiculous because of everything that Howard achieved. But I do think he's had a bigger effect on us, not as a fan base, but as on the city of Leeds, on the way we feel about ourselves, on who we are.
Nobody ever did a mural of Howard Wilkinson when he was managing Leeds, did they?
Well, they didn't. And you know, Howard, from what I've read, and he wouldn't have wanted it anyway. But you know, he deserves recognition. I think we've both given him that, you know, that the ending in 96 wasn't representative of everything that he achieved. And, you know, who knows what the ending with Bielsa will be like. But I would say that he's at least on a par with Howard in terms of what we've had as managers. And it's far more difficult to win things now. And, you know, we all know about his line about the tyranny of trophies. But he has achieved something better than that, I think. I mean, it's easy for me to say because, you know, I was 25 when we won the league. I've seen this team win the league. And I, you know, I can only speak for us old buggers, you know, that I want a club with integrity and values and you know, progress more than I'd love to win the FA Cup. I'd love to win the League Cup. I'd never seen us win those competitions. I was alive, but I didn't see them. But I'm happy for us to be where we are right now, back in the Premier League and back everybody talking about us as befitting our stature, really.
And I think that's a good point to say that if you want to know more about Leeds United's stature and how it befits having Marcelo Bielsa as manager, the biography of Leeds United, The Story of the Whites by Rob Bagchi, is published by VSP, Vision Sport.
That's right.
Yeah, I got that spot on. All good bookshops, isn't it?
It is, the ones that are open anyway. But
that's a point. I forgot. Yeah. Bookshop.org.uk.
Yeah.
That's the future, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And Amazon, if you have to. Thanks very much.
No, thank you. That was brilliant. Really enjoyed it.
The Extra Ball.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.